Hello, everyone, and welcome to What I Mean to Say, where our goal is to make science more accessible. Today, I have here with me a postdoc working with Dr. Nate Gruppel at Yale University, Anderson Brito. He has a PhD in computational biology from the Imperial College in London, UK. He is a communication manager for the Yale Postdoctoral Association, and previously the executive director of the Association of Brazilian Students and Researchers in the United Kingdom. He is passionate about Latin American partner dancing and molecular evolution, and he's my friend, Anderson Brito. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me here.
So great to have you. I've been really looking forward to this chat. Today we're going to be talking about COVID-19 in Brazil, which is a topic that I am fascinated with because I honestly don't know as much as I feel like I should. So what I'd like to start with is actually hear you describe a little bit about your work and personal background, and particularly how it relates to virology.
So I have a master's in microbiology, and that was the moment when I, let's say, when I started studying virology. And my research focus in that time was mostly studying genomics of insect virus. These viruses, they were being used for controlling populations of pests. So my research was about the genomic diversity of this virus, with the focus on like selecting the most pathogenic virus to be used as a bioinsecticide. These viruses, they are very specific to insects, so they are actually safer for being used as an insecticide than like chemicals.
Wow.
Chemicals have a really broad range of action, right? It can kill insects, but it can also kill us. These viruses, they are very specific to insects. They are unable to infect humans. That's how I got interested on viruses. And that's the reason that I decided to then, after my master's, to basically pursue a PhD in computational biology, but still studying viruses. But most specifically, I was studying multiple different aspects of the molecular evolution of herpes viruses specifically. So that was the moment when I jumped from insect viruses to human viruses.
For our listeners, could you just give us one example of a herpes virus that you might have studied?
One of the main ones I know, and many people may know, is the simplex viruses, which is a human virus that infects like many people. Many people have herpes viruses, but they just don't know, because some of the infections of herpes viruses are like chronic infections. So we kind of bear living with them infecting our body for like the course of our life, but only at specific points of our life when our immunity goes down, then we see some signs of that infection that was kind of running in the background, let's say, using a very computational example.
Wow, that is fascinating. So it sounds like when you're looking at the insect viruses, your focus was on deadlier viruses, viruses that acted quickly and would kill the insect right away. And then when you moved to human viruses, at least at first, you were looking at these simplex viruses that it's a more chronic infection. They stay with people for a long time. We may not realize it until our immune system is compromised and so on.
Yes, exactly.
Fantastic. So what drew your interest in going to Yale to work with Dr. Nate Gruppel?
So since my PhD times, my research was very theoretical. And I realized that it would be interesting if I could work on something that is more like, let's say, tangible. It's more related to people's lives. And then once I finished my PhD, I decided to move towards like something more related to epidemiology of viruses, because it's something that is useful. It's something that people can relate to. And then I found out about this open position of postdoc here at Yale, working at Dr. Gruppel lab, studying specifically the evolution of flaviviruses, which are viruses like dengue virus, Zika virus, yellow fever virus. They are all viruses that cause outbreaks in Brazil. Because now what I am doing is basically I am using genomic data to basically track how the viruses spread from place to place as an epidemic develops. Recently, I had to change my research topic for reasons that all of us know why. The COVID-19 pandemic started, and we need to like provide a quick response to this public health crisis. Then my research over the past 3 months has been all about SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes the COVID-19. I'm basically applying all the knowledge that I got from studying like insect viruses, herpes viruses, those very theoretical studies that they are now proving to be extremely important, because I feel that I am well equipped with all the expertise necessary for studying the virus that causes COVID-19.
It seems like you had a plan from the beginning almost, but serendipity brought us here and really gave you all the tools that you need to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. So let's take a little step back. Which part of Brazil are you from? And do you have any experience personally with any of the viruses that you've studied in the Rubal lab?
So I am originally from the capital of Brazil, Brasilia, and my link with virology and Brazil, as I explained, started in my undergrad times studying those viruses of agricultural importance. And now I am basically studying, for example, recent outbreaks that happened in Brazil in 2018 and 2019 of dengue viruses. We had these 2 years with very low dengue cases, and we still don't know why. In the year before, we had those massive Zika virus outbreaks in Brazil, and we suspect that the low number of dengue cases that we saw in those 2 years may be related to the fact that in the previous year, Brazil was facing a really massive outbreak of Zika virus. And now, COVID-19, my focus has mostly been on studying actually the outbreaks happening in the northeastern U.S., so I have not been too much involved on COVID-19 pandemic related to Brazil specifically.
That's so interesting. So for those who haven't been keeping track of the global picture of COVID-19, how has Brazil been dealing with the pandemic in terms of case numbers, fatality, and how does that compare to the United States?
Unfortunately, I have to say that my country has been doing quite badly in terms of controlling this epidemic, to be really honest. Brazil is among the countries, for example, that do less testing per million inhabitants. That's not a good sign, because if you are not testing, you are not seeing the real numbers of people who are infected day after day. And to fight an invisible enemy in the dark without really knowing what's the size of this enemy, where this enemy is, that's what testing does, right? If we test, we know how big is the problem and where the problem is. For this reason, I can say that Brazil is not really dealing with the problem with the level of seriousness that it requires. We were supposed to be testing way more. Like, there are data out there showing that right now we do around 14,000 tests per million inhabitants. That's really poor. Because if you look at countries that managed to control the outbreak, they did like 100,000 tests per million inhabitants. So we are way below that. So that's one of the reasons why I would say that we are not controlling that well. So far at the moment, we have more than 1 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 all over the country. Wow. It's a massive country, so the numbers follow that. And we have nearly 60,000 cases reported so far and rising. We never had the end of the first wave. What we have is just a massive single wave so far. And as the numbers grow, lives are claimed along the way. We have a really high level of underreporting going on. Lots of people die of COVID-like diseases that will never be tested. And yeah, we are facing lots of issues lately.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that testing is one of the main problems for Brazil. Why do you think they aren't testing more?
That's a good question. At the beginning, the number of tests were really low because of lack of resources. In early March, when our first cases were being reported, many other countries were facing the same issue all over the globe, meaning that competition for resources were really high. And unfortunately, since Brazil doesn't have a local industry that provides, for example, reagents for real-time PCR, which is the test which is really key for identifying people who are currently infected with the virus. If we cannot do that, what we would be doing is just like testing using antibodies, which is a good resource, but in terms of contact tracing and isolation of positive cases, antibody testing will not help. We need PCR because that's how we can really detect cases as the infection is evolving in a infected person.
And so just to be clear, for some of our listeners, the antibody test will quantify, it'll measure, okay, does your immune system respond or has it seen this virus before? And then the PCR test will essentially detect the actual virus inside a person's body or from a sample collected from a certain person's body.
Both kinds of tests, they are important, but they serve distinct purposes. The one that a country has to do quite a lot is real-time PCR is really important for contact tracing, for basically preventing new cases from happening, right? And basically, Brazil is not doing neither one or the other. It's not doing at the frequency that we would need to really get a sense of what is happening. So like Brazil has 1,300,000 cases. These are the reported cases. We know for sure that that number is really underreported and could be more than five times higher than that. The same for number of deaths. We probably have more than five times the number of deaths that we are seeing. And that applies not only to Brazil, but many other countries. For sure, the US has not been able to capture all possible cases because testing is a really huge bottleneck. That's why we see these very long queues in drive-through testing sites, because all countries are facing shortages of testing, basically.
That's really fascinating. So my understanding is that as of today, which is July 1st, 2020, there's about 10.5 million cases worldwide. So this is...
The way how we really should look at it is like looking at the relative estimate of like number of cases per million inhabitants. That's a good way to really get a sense on how good or how bad the situation is. Right now, for example, Chile and Brazil are the two countries with most cases per million of inhabitants in South America. And unfortunately, the news are not really good in terms of the number of cases in the US as well, because now the numbers are rising because of the outbreaks which are happening right now in southern US, right? Texas, Arizona, Florida, all of these states, they made bad choices in terms of reopening. It's clear that they were not following the guidelines that CDC put together in May.
So you mentioned that you saw some similarities and or differences between how Brazil's response to the pandemic and the US. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
I would like to basically give a few reasons. The first reasons are political reasons. So just like in the US, we have failed leadership, especially when we talk about the presidency of these two countries. They are not really helping. They are just another problem that we are facing alongside the virus, unfortunately. And this leads to this lack of coordination between national and state level policies. When at the national level, one thing is said, for example, like we should not worry about that. It's just the flu. It's going to go away in a few weeks. And in the other side, the governors are facing the real threat and saying this is a serious problem. We should stay at home. Another problem, slow action. This pandemic was giving its signs since January. The WHO was warning we should be prepared. And over 2 months, that was the same message that WHO was saying we should be prepared. This is spreading faster. And neither Brazil or the US were really doing much to be prepared to to face this issue that was coming, basically. So these are the political reasons that I could say. The
Fantastic. I'd like to stop here right there real quick. So it seems like these things are, the political reasons are pretty interrelated. In really kind of high level terms, what could we have done? And then now, what kind of things should we be doing?
So basically, the leaders that managed to respond to this threat in the appropriate way, all of them followed science. They made evidence-based decision. And those who failed, they just ignored science. And with their denial, all of those people, they were just ignored. Like in a Hollywood movie, the scientists were not heard at the beginning of the threat, and then the consequences came. And now the only thing that the poor leadership can do is to deny that the problem is that big, you know, or play with narratives to kind of convince people with fake news, misinformation, trying to convince them that everything that was possible to be done, like, was done. But that's not really true. Now, with a pandemic, it's not possible to lie, because the facts, they come back at you as waves of cases, as waves of people dying, as waves of hospitals getting to collapse. And there's no way to deny that, right? Other waves, like waves of people dying, but not anonymous people, people with names, faces that we know and recognize. That's the moment when it's impossible to deny the problem. So the other reasons that I would like to list, for example, to explain the high number of cases in Brazil specifically, and to some extent in the US as well, but in different levels, are socioeconomic reasons. Many people in Brazil, they unfortunately cannot stop working for 1 week, because if they do that, they don't get ways to afford their living. Brazil failed to provide financial aid to these people that cannot work from home and cannot stop working at all. And just like in the US, Brazil, it's a very unequal society where very rich and very poor people, they basically live in the same neighborhood, basically. And this is a scenario where we can see those who can work from home, doing home office. And right in the other side of the wall, we see people that work on the streets. If they stay at home, they don't earn their livings. So that's a social issue that is now driving this epidemic in Brazil. Another issue relates to science literacy, which in many communities in Brazil, it's very low. So many people, they barely know what is a virus and how to protect themselves against a viral infection. And that leads to lots of anxiety, because if you don't know how you get infected, you cannot protect yourself. Then you start with lots of very, let's say, paranoia-like behavior to protect yourself, you know, like rubbing your hands with hand sanitizer every 5 minutes and spending lots of money with that, while what you should do is to isolate yourself from other people, you know, like stay at distance, at least 6 feet from other people. That's the key message. But that's not happening because people don't know what is risky and what is not risky, you know. And the last point, the less social reasons, for example, about the lack of conditions to stay at home. Because if you live with 6 people in the same household and your house only has like 2 rooms and one of those living there is sick, how are you going to isolate yourself and prevent the whole family from being infected? That's just not possible. That's what is happening right now in the favelas in Brazil, which are slums, right? And briefly, talking about cultural reasons, by stupid choices coming from people, they can just choose not to comply to social distancing orders. There are people out there who have conditions to stay at home, they can work from home, but they don't do much to really comply with the social distancing measures, which unfortunately, since we don't have a vaccine, we don't have medicines which are really effective against the virus. The social distancing measures are the only tools that we have, but people choose not to use that. They refuse to use masks. That's a big issue right now here in the US, and I fear that at some point it will hit Brazil, because unfortunately lots of things that happen here end up getting there. And the last point is about the lack of understanding about the scientific facts that makes lots of people being easy praise for fake news and misinformation in social media. Lots of people are not socially isolating because they receive this information on their social media that convince them from not doing what should be done.
Yeah, thank you so much for that comprehensive answer. In preparing for this, I was reading articles online, and I found that the Brazilian Institute of Geography and Statistics had released a report talking about how 7.8 million people lost work in Brazil. So they're now jobless. So out of the 7.8 million, 5.8 million were workers in the informal economy, meaning that the government doesn't tax them and it's not monitored by the government in any way.
And many of these people, they are now being called the invisible, in a sense that they are not in the government databases so that they can get the financial aid that over the past 2 months, the government started providing financial aid, which is really good. It's one of the few things that were done correctly, because that really helps people to stay at home and really protect themselves and their communities.
Wow. Yeah. Just to give some of our American listeners a little bit of perspective. So this institute, the study that I referenced, if you look at all the people in Brazil, that comes to 49.5% of the people without a job. One thing that I wanted to kind of touch back on is science education. I think that literacy is incredibly important. And in fact, testing, I like to say, is really, if you're not changing people's behavior, testing is just measuring how much you're failing. For our listeners who are maybe in Brazil or are Brazilian, or, you know, in the US, in Connecticut and Boston and San Francisco, if they want to learn more about COVID-19 or the pandemic, what would you say are trusted sources?
I would say that people should look for information in official sources of trusted information, like the CDC in the US. They do a really great job at instructing people on what they have to do, for example, to protect themselves and their families. And they go very specific in the details, but in a very simple language. That's something that I should say that we miss in Brazil quite a lot. I have been doing science communication over the past months, and I have been using the CDC website and translating some of that information into Portuguese quite frequently, because it's a reliable source of information. Social media can also play a good role here, but the problem is that you have to find trusted people to follow, right? Because nowadays we have millions of epidemiologists or wannabe epidemiologists, people who have no background at all on public health, but are out there providing their opinions with no evidence at all. There are lots of scientists out there doing a really great job at communicating science on Twitter. Like, you just have to find them, because there are lots of people out there which are making a huge effort and spending hours of their weeks translating the complex science and very jargon-like language into something that is more digestible, is too easy to understand in multiple languages. I've been following lots of people which are like English speakers or Spanish speakers, Portuguese speakers, of course, which are doing a really great job. So we should look for these two sources, like the actual scientists online and the official sources of information like CDC, WHO. They collect lots of information that are circulating as fake news, and they are trying to debunk that. And the information is all in English, which is great for those who speak the language. But unfortunately, it's not available in other languages as well. So then that's when native speakers of second languages can come and try to help somehow translate that information into other languages. But yeah, we do have lots of resources out there. It's just a matter of being interested, right? And search for it, because we do have lots of points to get good information from.
Fantastic. And we can actually include in the description of this podcast a list of some resources, specifically links to the CDC and the WHO, as well as Twitter handles of several leading scientists in COVID-19 yeah. research. I'll also include your handle, as well as Nate Grubaugh, who you work with, and few others at Yale and elsewhere. We'll compile a list to make that available. So I think a lot of my extended family, my friends that I have that are not scientists, are not really aware of the fact or the extent to which scientists actually use social media. And this is one way where, you know, normally if someone wanted information about science, they wanted to go to a journal, for example, to read a journal article. It costs tens of thousands of dollars, right?
Yeah, like, if I could mention as well, because I forgot to mention that the media is really doing a really great job. I should say that the biggest journals in the US, like the New York Times, Washington Post, they are really doing a great job with animations and infographics and consulting scientists to hear from them what we have as evidences in the latest articles that were released. I've been talking quite a lot with journalists, and most of them make a huge effort. They study the topics for like days before writing. So they really collect all the evidences, the opinions from experts as well. So yeah, I would include this third component, the trusted media. They are really doing a really great job, science communication.
That's really great. I think we have a ton of content here. I really appreciate you taking the time to meet with us. Is there anything else that maybe if you had one key point or a last final message for people in the US, for people in Brazil, people who are not scientists, who are out there, they're wondering what an expert, a scientist, would tell them if they only had a brief message to reach them.
Yeah, so I would say that I have to emphasize that this pandemic is true. It's a reality. And the virus spreads in a way that it doesn't care if you believe that the virus exists or not. It just spreads. So viruses, they don't take holiday times. If it's weekend, the virus will spread in the weekends as well. So we may all be tired of this viral epidemic, but the viruses, they are not tired of us. And many of us, we are still susceptible to this virus, unfortunately. Some of us may get infected and just have mild symptoms. Most of the people, they either get an infection with mild symptoms or barely no symptoms at all. The problem is that these people are the ones spreading the virus further to people who are in the elderly people or people with some, let's say, comorbidities. And that's the biggest point that explains why we are having a hard time controlling the epidemic. We should follow the guidelines that CDC and any public health institutions are providing us, because those are information that come from experts, from people who really know how to handle this situation. And this epidemic will not be over if we don't listen to scientists, to doctors, and what they have to say, because a solution will only come from evidence-based policies.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. I think having a plan is the first step. And then that plan needs to be driven by evidence, by data. What is the, and it's, the results are often complicated. And that's why you need experts to guide you and how to invest your resources in preventing further outbreaks.
Yeah, so, exactly. Because denial will only lead us to second waves, third waves, fourth waves, and so on. We'll see exactly
absolutely
what we are seeing right now, right? If we are having a second wave, it's because because people are not listening to who they should listen to.
Yeah, so hopefully through this podcast or other efforts that we do as people who are trained in biology specifically, who in virology, working on the pandemic, doing work that's directly related, we can do just our part, no matter how small it is, we do our part to make the science a little bit more accessible, a little bit more open, something that people can understand, directly relate to, and know where to go next.
Exactly.
Because that's kind of the key point.
And the sort of forecast that Minta is doing, it's really important to translate complex scientific content into a language that people can really understand, answering questions that many people may have out there. And yeah, thank you very much for inviting me to be here.
I really appreciate you joining us. This has been excellent.